This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehigis Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If confirmed as having been deliberately carried out by a party to the current fighting, these killings of civilians would, of course, amount to war crimes, and there must be an independent investigation and full accountability for what has happened. However, the first priority right now must be to stop the fighting and prevent any further atrocities from taking place.
That was Rupert Colville, spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, expressing alarm at the rapidly deteriorating situation in Ethiopia's Tigray region, especially of allegations of mass killings. Details coming up also. There is new hope in the world whereby a biopharmaceutical firm announced promising results in very early trial for a coronavirus vaccine. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet warns escalating fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region could spiral out of control if allowed to continue much longer. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than a week of fighting between the Ethiopian army and forces of the Tigray regional government has resulted in civilian casualties and widespread destruction of homes and infrastructure. Reports of mass human rights violations have sent thousands of people fleeing for safety. More than 14,500 Ethiopians have fled to Sudan, and the UN Refugee Agency says more people are on their way. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is expressing alarm at the rapidly deteriorating situation in Tigray. Her spokesman, Rupert Colville, says she's particularly disturbed by an Amnesty International report of alleged mass killings in Mai Kadra in southwest Tigray. He says the report has not been verified, and the High Commissioner is calling for a full inquiry to determine what happened.
If confirmed as having been deliberately carried out by a party to the current fighting, these killings of civilians would, of course, amount to war crimes, and there must be an independent investigation and full accountability for what has happened. However, the first priority right now must be to stop the fighting and prevent any further atrocities from taking place.
Amnesty said photographs and videos of the scene indicate hundreds of people were stabbed or hacked to death. It says the victims appear to have been day laborers who were not involved in military operations. Colville says the High Commissioner has also received reports of increased airstrikes by Ethiopian government forces and of fierce ground fighting between opposing military forces. He says Bachelet also is alarmed at reports of cuts to water and electricity supplies, as well as the communications blackout. He says Bachelet is renewing her appeal for both sides to stop fighting and to start talking.
She is strongly urging both sides to realize that there will be no winner in such a situation and calls on them to begin a serious dialogue to resolve their differences without delay. The High Commissioner warns that a protracted internal conflict will inflict devastating damage on both Tigray and Ethiopia as a whole, undoing years of vital development progress.
Colville says the High Commissioner is fearful of the consequences if Tigray and Ethiopia fail to heed her warning. If fighting continues, he says she fears the conflict could easily spill across borders, potentially destabilizing parts of East Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There was reason for new hope in the world on Monday when the Pfizer biopharmaceutical firm announced promising results in very early trials for a coronavirus vaccine. And although it may be a half a year before any vaccine by Pfizer or an estimated 200 other companies is approved by regulators and made available, national health ministries are already planning ways to acquire, pay for, and distribute it. To find out more about the challenges, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Jesse Goodman, a professor of medicine and infectious disease at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and a former chief scientist at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
One particular issue is access and affordability. The good news on that is global organizations are getting together, including WHO, CEPI, which has funded some of the R&D, Gavi, which finances vaccines for lower-income nations, not having this be something accessible just to well-off or Western nations.
Tell us about the challenges that you contemplate for the West and Africa once a safe coronavirus vaccine is available.
Certainly, distribution of vaccines to large numbers of people, being sure that can be safely done. Tracking the doses. In many cases, you may need to track for a second dose. Most of these early vaccines are two-dose vaccines. So there's a huge logistic challenge for any country, and then for countries without as much healthcare infrastructure or funding, it could be really significant.
Can you give me a specific problem that will have to be addressed when distributing this vaccine? I'm thinking especially of remote and rural places.
Sure. Most vaccines already need to be protected when they're stored and transported by being in the cold. That might be normal freezing or refrigeration. But, for example, the earliest vaccines out, or at least the current one that's gotten all the attention in the last week of Pfizer's, have to be transported at what we call ultra-low temperatures. And that uses freezers that aren't generally accessible, even in the U.S.
What happens if those double-dose vaccines get too warm?
They can lose their potency and they won't be effective. But there are many other vaccines being studied, something like 200 candidates globally, and several of them will probably only require one dose. So those will be much easier vaccines to use logistically.
Of course, there's also psychology at play here. Some folks here in the U.S. and in Africa simply don't trust vaccines of any kind.
Yeah, and we've seen that generated or exploited politically in the past. And there's a lot of mistrust of the pharmaceutical industry. Added to that, there is the global perception that because these are new vaccines and have been sped up in their research and development process, that they might not be safe. And so I think the communication about what is known about these vaccines is going to be really important, because you could have the best vaccine in the world, but if people don't trust it and don't trust the person or system administrating it, we're not going to be able to use them to help end the pandemic. And I would say one other issue for countries that are challenged in terms of their resources is, how much of a problem do they see COVID, and how does it compare to some of their other challenges? We see COVID in the scientific community as a highly contagious disease that could be quite severe and fatal, particularly for individuals with underlying conditions or older individuals. But some countries may be comparing that to potential resource use, for example, to measles, where the world is falling behind because of this COVID outbreak. So it's also going to be that countries are going to have to make decisions about where this fits in their priorities.
How does the COVID pandemic and its challenges compare to the Ebola outbreak of several years ago?
Very different diseases. Ebola, you know, requiring very close contact generally, but relatively easy to control, although obviously it took Herculean efforts. But public health measures could be quite effective there, even though the disease is more severe and terrifying, which certainly motivated people living in those countries to be interested in the vaccine. But on the other hand, coronavirus, much more common, much more contagious. I think we're going to learn a lot from it. It's still not clear where the money comes from. People have to raise the money every time there's a crisis. You know, this is true of global health in general. There really should be some kind of global health budget that when there's an emergency can be drawn from. We need to be better prepared the next time, because this isn't going to be the last pandemic.
That was Dr. Jesse Goodman, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Georgetown University, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. UN envoy Stephanie Williams says political talks on Libya's future have reached preliminary agreement on a roadmap to free, fair, inclusive, and credible parliamentary and presidential elections within 18 months. She says the agreement also includes steps to unite institutions. Yesterday's talks in Tunis focused on a new unified transitional government to oversee the run-up to elections. The roadmap outlines steps to begin a process of national reconciliation and transitional justice and address the plight of displaced people. William Lawrence is professor of political science at the American University in Washington. He explains the prospects of reaching a political solution in Libya to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
What we know so far looks promising. Second, its date and a roadmap for elections is not a comprehensive political solution. The more important aspect is the unification of institutions. There's a myth regarding Libya that elections derailed the Libyan transition to democracy, but what derailed it was the anti-democratic elements that wanted to gain power without elections, not through elections, and chiefly Field Marshal Haftar, but he was not the only one. Then the institutions divided between East and West, so bringing back those institutions together is the first step following the ceasefire. The UN-led negotiation process has been very successful with three tracks, the military track, the economic track, and the political track. But the political track had made the least progress until now. And now, with these latest announcements, we can begin to see the light at the end of the tunnel. The negotiation process was also helped by two other key elements. One was the introduction of Turkish forces that rebalanced Russian and Emirati-funded forces who were backing the anti-democratic solution proposed by General Haftar. The Turkish intervention aligned with UN and American interests and allowed a settlement to be negotiated. The second aspect was Stephanie Williams, the acting envoy, has been far more effective than her predecessors during the war, Lyon, Kobler, and Salome. She worked under all of them. She knew the account extremely well. She's trusted by Libyans, and she fixed the errors made by her predecessors.
Thursday talks in Tunisia focused on a new unified transitional government to oversee the run-up to the elections. The roadmap also outlines steps to begin process of national reconciliation, transitional justice, and address the plight of displaced people in Libya. Is that practically feasible?
Yes. As long as the ceasefire holds and there's unified institutions, everything is possible. Reconciliation is a multi-year process, but needs to begin right away. And in Libya, that has as much to do with communal reconciliation, because there were dozens of communal conflicts around Libya, as well as the national reconciliation. But on the national side, there need to be trust-building measures and transparent, accountable processes. And with that, anything's possible. On transitional justice, the first step is often just to let people tell their stories, to tell their truths. And for Libya, this will have even more to do with the Gaddafi period. And there's decades of suffering people need to let out and to discuss to move forward. Libyans have to be given a chance to reveal the past, to make up for the past, heal their wounds. As for the displaced people, there are millions of displaced Libyans inside and outside the country, and millions of African migrants as well. And there's a lot that can be done through UN organizations and international and local NGOs to address those issues, starting with COVID-19, which is afflicting the migrant and displaced populations.
Could the initial roadmap reached in the Libyan dialogue in Tunisia be derailed by Libyan rivals?
Yes, that's always been an issue with any convening of Libyans. The political parties are weak. Gaddafi atomized civil society, and no one really represents anybody else. So any process in Libya will have to be long and careful and comprehensive, transparent, accountable. The parliament's assertion that it has to be the place where it happens is wrong, because their terms in office have long expired. The Libyan political agreement, which would have given them some legitimacy, they never ratified it. And the 2014 elections had very low turnout and don't really confer the legitimacy they think. So there'll have to be new elections. There will have to be a convening of the power brokers. And Libyans never agree on who it should be, so it's going to be tricky. The general rule is you have to have a few people around the table, the big players who control military forces, to make those deals, as we've been seeing in the military dialogue that's going on. And on the other hand, you need very big conferences where all the communities, ethnic groups, and identity groups, everything from all around Libya get a chance to say their piece and participate in the discussion, enlarging the tent and widen the circle so that more diverse Libyans can be part of the political process.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The death of former President Jerry John Rawlings has shocked Ghana, where he was seen as a widely beloved champion of democracy, despite originally taking power in a military coup. The country's longest-serving president died yesterday at age 73 in a hospital where he has been admitted for treatment for unspecified condition. Mavis Ochera in Ghana has more.
The former Air Force officer first appeared on the Ghanaian political scene in 1979 when he led a group of junior officers in an unsuccessful coup that resulted in his arrest and imprisonment. He was court-martialed in public and sentenced to death due to his display of patriotism. In his defense speeches, he was widely seen as a true son of Ghana, and he was nicknamed Junior Jesus for his initials, JG. Major Boachi Jan and his men also set Rawlings free from prison and installed him as head of new government, the Armed Forces Revolutionary Council. Rawlings served as head of state in 1981 through 1992 after coming to power in a coup. He won the maximum two terms as president in 1993 to 2001. He was an ardent champion for moral principles, accountability, and integrity both in government and after he left office. Fritz Bafo, a former government minister and legislator, called the death of Rawlings a big blow to Ghana. He described the former president, a trailblazer, who played diverse roles in helping Ghana sustain democratic rule.
He laid the foundation for a long-lasting democracy in this country. So naturally, and Ghana is now the example of democratic rule throughout the world, or throughout Africa.
Bafo says Rawlings had a huge influence in his life, providing support and mentoring as he ventured into politics. He says the former president truly cared for the ordinary Ghanaian.
I saw all sides of him, but I saw his compassionate side, his kind side, his very caring side, and the humility he showed when he was dealing with people, the common man and woman on the street. He had, they were very much in his heart, and every time he talked about how their welfare was paramount in his thoughts and in his practice. So, in reality, Ghana has lost a great icon.
Paul Yafrimpong Manson, president of the Ghana Pentecostal and Charismatic Council, says he was shocked by Rawlings' death.
You can see that Rawlings is really a bulwark, an oak tree, somebody who will always be a reference point in Ghanaian politics, our sociology, our religion, and everything. Without Rawlings in Africa, Africa is not going to be the same. He is a great loss.
President Akufo-Addo has directed all national flags fly at half-staff during a seven-day period of national mourning starting today for the man who, over his lifetime, gained massive love from the public. The government says it will work closely with Rawlings' family on arrangements for a state funeral. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
A helicopter involving a multinational observer force crashed yesterday in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, killing seven people, five Americans, a French national, and a Czech citizen. An eighth peacekeeper was badly injured. The multinational force and observers, known as MFO, said the helicopter was on a routine mission near Sharm el-Sheikh, a popular Egyptian resort city on the Red Sea. An investigation is underway. Islamic militant groups and a regional affiliate of the Islamic State group are known to be active in the Sinai. But the MFO said there was no signs of an attack. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa's determination to fight graft displayed tangible evidence today as his ruling party's Secretary General, Ace Magashule, appeared in court facing corruption charges. Facing an arrest warrant, Magashule turned himself to the National Prosecuting Authority today. However, as Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, his arrest laid bare the serious divisions within the ruling African National Congress.
Corruption, fraud, and money laundering. These are the charges that Mahashule faces in connection with a $16 million tender which the Free State government issued at the time he was the premier of the province. The money was paid, but no work was done. Allegations claim Mahashule scored over $600,000 in kickbacks. The court released him on $13,000 bail. He is scheduled to return to court in February. However, his arrest has made distinct the divisions within the ruling party. Two large groups of the ANC, one in support and the other against him, taunted each other outside the court. One unidentified Mahashule supporter accused Ramaphosa of being behind his arrest.
It is Ramaphosa creating this. Now this is a symbol showing that in the ANC, Ramaphosa is no longer welcome.
But a protester in the opposing faction hit back at Mahashule.
We've been struggling in Free State, so we want justice to be served today. We want him to go to jail.
During the previous ANC leadership election conference, Mahashule supported the faction that wanted Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma to be president. Ramaphosa's faction won and elected him president instead. ANC Deputy Secretary General Jesse Duarte, however, dismissed the suggestions that the two factions at the court were an indication of deep divisions within the party leadership, even though some members were seen burning T-shirts with the face of Ramaphosa.
What we will not accept is ill discipline and burning of the T-shirts of the face of the president. That is the president of the ANC, and he will remain the president of the ANC.
Political analyst Lesiba Tefo says it's a development that should get everyone worried.
A limping ANC is not good for the country. The ANC is a very, very, very fragile organization. And as a result, one is very, very concerned.
In the past month, several top ANC figures have been arrested for alleged corruption. Many have applauded Ramaphosa for the arrest, but others accuse him of using them to punish opponents within the party. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A jihadist attack has killed 14 soldiers in Burkina Faso in the latest deadly attack in the troubled Sahel region. The French news agency AFP says the attack took place Wednesday in the country's north near the border with Mali and Niger. The government says the ambush is one of the worst attacks on the army since the jihadist insurgency flared up 5 years ago. Such attacks have left at least 1,200 dead and forced more than a million from their homes. Experts say the escalating insecurity in Burkina Faso is troubling, particularly with the country due to hold a presidential election on November 22nd. President Marc Christian Kabore, who is seeking re-election, launched his campaign last week by promising to bring peace to the country, something that critics claimed he couldn't do in his first term. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.